On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Renegade husband and wife philosophers Pat and Paul Churchland met 40 years ago in a college Plato class. Their instincts as philosophers then and now run outside the mainstream, where most philosophers looked to reason and logic to apprehend the human mind. The Churchlands looked and look to science. There is no independent mind, these two practically say, just the human brain, 3 pounds of tissue and water firing away behind all our emotions, beliefs, actions. Consciousness itself, they say, straight biology, a machine. Once that sounded esoteric, now it's on the front line of debates over law, soul, and life. Up next on Point, Pat and Paul Churchland on the mind as straight science. I should say later in this hour we'll be joined by the eminent philosopher Colin McGinn, who has strongly disagreed with the Churchland's approach. But first, joining me now from San Diego are Patricia and Paul Churchland. They're professors of philosophy at the University of California, San Diego. They've written extensively on the brain, mind. Paul Churchland is author of Neurophilosophy at Work. Patricia Churchland is author of Brainwise, Studies in Neurophilosophy. They were featured in the New Yorker magazine last month in an article titled Two Heads, A Marriage Devoted to the Mind-Body Problem. Patricia and Paul Churchland, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
Hello, Tom. It's a great pleasure to talk to you.
It's great to have you both. The very idea, there was a terrific piece, we thought, by Larissa McFarquhar in the New Yorker, describing you two after nearly 40 years together as practically one great bundle of neurophilosophy. Was she kidding, Patricia, Paul, or do you see your minds, your brains as practically a condominium now working together?
Well, you know, it's been great fun, and it's been great fun because the issues are so tremendously exciting. And we happened to be very lucky in realizing early on that neuroscience was going to teach us an enormous amount about the nature of the mind. And so as neuroscience has developed and experimental psychology has developed, we have just found the discussion and the implications for philosophy just enormously interesting.
Well, let me ask you, Paul, please, yes.
I should add, Tom, that the neuroscience community and the psychology community and the computer science community in general have been very welcoming over the past 20 and 30 years, both in our years in Canada and in our years down here at UC San Diego. It's an interdisciplinary hotbed here, and it's been a wonderful community to be a part of. This isn't just an enterprise of a couple of renegade philosophers, as I think the blurb said. This is an enterprise of three or four disciplines all working together.
Positively, and we've seen signs of that receptivity, especially on the science side, but we're also from kind of a civilian level aware of the controversy on the philosopher side. I mean, let me put it to you. I guess I think we have some understanding of what neuroscience is, the science of the brain, and we think we have some idea what philosophy is. But Patricia, Paul, what's neurophilosophy?
Well, Pat entitled her first book Neurophilosophy, so by rights, she should be answering this question.
All right,
but,
all right.
Okay, well,
she gestured to me, so I've started. But Pat, okay. Why don't you tell them what neurophilosophy
well,
is?
Well, the way I thought of it, and I mean, it was really the way the two of us thought of it in the 70s and 80s, was really very simple, that philosophers have traditionally been very interested in questions about the nature of knowledge and how we manage to learn and remember and know anything, the nature of perception, how it is that we can have some sort of understanding of what's out there in the external world, and also the nature of decision-making, consciousness, and so forth. Mm. And what we thought, and I think this is clearly being borne out now, is that rather than looking only to one's sort of intuitions about these things, that the sciences both of behavior, psychology, and of the brain, neuroscience, would teach us a lot about how these things actually work. Now, this wasn't something that was possible for David Hume in the 18th century because the science wasn't there. Mm-hmm. But for us in the 20th century, the science began to be there. And of course, as you know, it's grown and grown to the point where the interface between these old, wonderful, traditional questions and neuroscience just got richer and richer.
Paul, take us into that interface. I mean, the mind-body problem has been around forever. I wish you'd, for those of us who aren't philosophers and don't practice this, remind us of what the mind-body problem is in philosophy, going all the way back to the ancients, and then spin us forward, if you would, to the new insights on that front today that science, neuroscience, is bringing us.
Well, I'll try. Humans have had a fairly intricate and clever conception of the kinds of beings they are from the Greek times and indeed thousands of years before. If you read the Greek poets and the Greek plays, they are using the same vocabulary and dealing with the same issues about love and hate and fate and tragedy that we discuss today. But they didn't know anything about the internal organ that now appears is sustaining all of that wonderful activity. Mm. The mind-body problem has been the problem of how to square the complex phenomena that we think of as mental phenomena with the equally complex physical and electrical and chemical phenomena going on in the brain. How is the mind on the one hand related to the body on the other? And there's been a long tradition familiar to everybody even in this century that the mind is a non-physical thing which somehow interacts with the brain, something that might have existed before the body came into being, something that might survive bodily death. This is standard substance dualism. Expression comes from Descartes' philosophy primarily, since he's its modern exponent. And those sorts of views, accounts of the relation, were contrasted with those who said, no, there's a much closer relation. The mind really is just the brain, or a mind is a properly functioning brain, and everything that goes on in the mind, all of our hopes and fears and dreams and itches and tickles and so forth, are really nothing more than activities in the nervous system. This wasn't a very popular view until, well, it began to become quite popular after Charles Darwin, when he gave us a story which seemed to unite us with all of the other creatures on the planet. And people were perfectly willing to see their behavior as being governed by the activity of a nervous system. Humans just got swept up in the biological story as time rolled by. There are other subtleties, but that's the first great division between dualistic theories of mind and those that attempt to identify mental phenomena with phenomena going on in the brain.
And you're taking that science piece and writing it way out into philosophy. Patricia, I imagine that when you sit with students at the college level, many of them, despite the sort of evolution in our human thinking about all this and our greater understanding of biology, they probably still bring that sense of a mind independent of biology at some level into the classroom. How do you explain this much more immediately brain-oriented view of philosophy that you've got to newcomers to your realm?
Well, that's a good question, because I think there is a kind of intuitive feeling, and it's part of what the brain does for us, that one's mental life is not the same as or could not be described in terms of the physical brain. But the way I approach it with students is really recapitulates the way I learned about it myself. And so let me give you one example.
Please.
One of the most extraordinary experiences I had in viewing a neurological patient was a patient of the de Masios in Iowa City. And this was a man who had suffered as a result of a virus the destruction of the hippocampal structures on both sides of his brain. Now, the hippocampus is a little bit of very old cortex, sort of tucked way into the middle of the brain.
Okay.
And the extraordinary thing about RB was that you could meet him, and for the first few minutes, he seemed very normal. He was very social. He had would greet you in a very charming way. But then it became quickly apparent that he was incapable of learning anything new, so that he would meet you, but then if he turned away from you and was distracted, he'd turn back and say, "Oh, hello, how very nice to meet you, and what's your name?"
We've
seen that in the movies, 51st Dates, I remember, with Adam Sandler and something like that. Okay.
So to meet someone who had a very compromised memory, he also had absolutely no autobiographical memory. He didn't know that he was married. He had no idea where he grew up. He had no idea whether he had children and so forth. And yet, so there was this whole part of himself that was lost as a result of losing these particular brain structures. And I found that to be a kind of remarkable event. And we see that elsewhere in clinical neurology, and that is that very specific, complex, sophisticated mental functions can be lost or compromised when a very specific part of brain tissue is lost. And this makes us realize, in a way that was very different from how Descartes thought about it, that there are these dependencies between mental functions and brain functions, and that the dependencies are so close that it motivates the hypothesis that really mental states are, in fact, states of the physical brain.
Pat and Paul, we've got a lot of listeners who have questions for you. If you don't mind, I'll go straight to them. Stephen's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hi. I've got one comment and a question. We just had a little daughter. We have a little baby daughter.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. She's wonderful. One of the things you have to do as a new parent is learn how to calm this little crying baby. And so
no kidding.
There's a lot of tricks you do, which are basically just evolutionary psychology reflexes, and it all works very well, thankfully. And there's no, you know, there's no real surprises there. You do these things and it works because it's just reflexes and instinct. So I find it very, you know, having this little baby and going through this process, I find it remarkable that anybody could think that there's any little miracles going on in her brain or anything that's non-physical or non-evolutionary psychology.
Rock them, hold them close, feed them, sing something soothing, and off she goes. One hopes, Stephen.
Yeah, and so my question is, given, you know, just given observation of babies and human beings in general, if anybody does think that there's some non-physical or miracles or magic going on in the brain, why don't And they want to bring people to faith, as many faiths are called to do, why don't they devote themselves and their resources to demonstrating any supposed miracles or magic in the brain? And I would suggest one answer is because they're afraid of the answer. It would be just one more example of faith or magic to explain anything that's going on in the world.
Stephen, thanks for your call. Pat, Paul, it's not just some purveyors of religion who might have questions here. It's other philosophers as well. But what about Stephen's question? At this point, does anyone doubt in the philosophy community that it's biology at work?
Well, let me just put it one way, and that is that Stephen's point is very well taken. There, so far as I know, there really is no research program that is trying to develop the dualistic hypothesis, that is really looking for data and that really has an established and flourishing program to show that dualism is true. But the other point I wanted to make that will link up with Stephen's point on this is that we have, in the last decade, learned something about what happens when you have a new baby, what happens in your brain, and that is that there is a flood of oxytocin. And oxytocin is a very simple peptide, but a very important peptide. It binds to certain receptors in the front part of your brain, and those neurons connect to neurons in the reward system. And if it all works normally, you have these powerful feelings of love. You see this child as the most beautiful thing on the earth, even though it might be sort of red and wrinkly and doesn't look appealing to anybody else. And that's oxytocin at work. Now, of course, from the inside, it feels like love and adoration. From the brain's point of view, that's mainly oxytocin doing its job.
So, Paul, does that mean one day we're all going to sit around talking about oxytocin flows and I don't know how my synapses are clicking today? Does emotion become something antique? At least in the way we've understood
it? That's a wonderful question for you to pose me. I think that We will come to talk about our oxytocin levels and our dopamine levels and our serotonin levels. I think as we learn what the neurochemistry is of a normal, healthy, emotional life, we will be seeing more accurately into the phenomena that are taking place. That will allow us, it won't take away anything from the joy and the satisfaction and the relaxation and the adoration, but it will allow us to see more accurately into the minds of other people and into the minds of babies and into the minds of those we love. If we can see more accurately what's actually going on inside each other's heads, more accurately than we currently do, then we'll be in a position to take better care of each other. We'll be in a position to see unhappinesses coming and to head them off. We'll be more skilled at pouring oil on troubled waters. I think that the future of scientific knowledge here will enrich our conception of ourselves, and it'll make us better persons for it.
I know there's philosophical pushback on this front. We're going to hear it in a moment from philosopher Colin McGinn, who will join us. But let me get just at least another call here. Carl is calling from Boston. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks, Tom, for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think the idea of the philosophy of science is very interesting. But I have a question to pose, which is, how do you see your role in this interdisciplinary field? Do you feel that you're there to provide questions for scientists to answer, or do you feel that you're there more so to explain the answers that scientists come up with in a way that is more favorable to the general masses?
Pat, Paul?
Well, I think for different philosophers, there will be different roles. In fact, I think Paul and I don't have exactly the same role either, but part of what I see myself as doing is playing a kind of synthetic role where I have the luxury, because I'm not an experimental scientist, of roving across many, many subfields of psychology and neuroscience and sort of pulling things together in an interesting way. So that, for example, right now I'm deeply interested in the nature of moral behavior, which means that I get lots of help from research in psychology, but also the story of oxytocin and vasopressin and monogamous pair bonding, but also from evolutionary biology and the animal behavior people. So that's how I see myself. But other philosophers can do other things. I mean, there's many things to do. I think the what you don't want to do is sort of insist that conceptual analysis where you sit in the armchair and keep all science at bay. I think that's probably a dead end.
There's the rub, and we'll talk about that. Let me get another call from Hilton Head, South Carolina. Stephanie is on the line. Hi, Stephanie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm just calling because I have spent my whole life being interested in all of these things that you're talking about. And I'm 35, and I just found out that I have attention deficit disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder.
Okay.
And so I'm finally understanding why I've been obsessed my whole life with trying to figure out why I do what I do and not being able to accomplish everything I'm wanting to do.
Humans obsessed since time immemorial, and you maybe more than most.
Yes, exactly. And yet my ADD makes me wander too much. I'm just finishing my doctorate in physical therapy and want to specialize in neurological disorders. And I think this is because I've been trying to incorporate philosophy and neuroscience and everything and biology.
So what's your question for the Churchlands, Stephanie? What's your question today?
Well, my question today is, well, I guess it was just a comment just to say that I'm so excited to hear what they're talking about, because I really think it's where I've come to in my own evolved thinking of understanding brain functioning and not functioning perfectly. So I guess that's my comment.
Stephanie, thanks very much for that. Paul, Pat, a response?
Hers is a heartening comment. If she now has a feeling of control or power, and more than a feeling, maybe she has some actual control and some actual power over her condition, because she's learned some of the theory of how the brain works and how it doesn't work, then, good for her. She'll probably do better having demystified what was a mystery. Hers is an example that has many similar cases. Depression has been a malady from which a good portion of the human race suffers, at least at some point in their life. And that is something that we have managed to come to understand a little better and to deal with the various kinds of antidepressants. I'm here thinking of chronic major depression, not the occasional blues that every normal brain gets. Things can go into a bad state, and it used to be we didn't understand at all what was going on. We do now, and drugs like Lexapro and fluoxetine and all of the serotonin uptake, reuptake inhibitors have improved a lot of thousands of people's lives. These are things on the good side. On the whole, I think the good things are going to outweigh the bad things, but I'm an optimist, and one has to be careful here.
We're talking philosophy. It can sound a lot like biology or neuroscience. In the case of Patricia and Paul Churchland, they're very close to the same thing, but this is not what they're expressing here today, a universally held view in the philosophical community. I want to open the door to another philosopher right now to bring some of that onto the table, if he'd be good enough. Colin McGinn joins us from Miami, Florida. He's professor of philosophy at the University of Miami, author of The Mysterious Flame and The Making of a Philosopher. It's been a couple years now since we've spoken, but it's great to have you back, Colin McGinn. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hello. Glad to be here.
So here we are. We're getting the Churchland's view of where philosophy and neuroscience may meet and interact. Give us a sense of the pushback that's been that this approach has generated in the philosophical community.
Well, I'm getting into this discussion in the middle, of course, but let me just respond to the kinds of points that came up. I'm sympathetic to the positive side of what Pat and Paul are saying. I think anybody would recognize that it's important to know about the brain in trying to understand the mind, especially if you're interested in more psychological questions about the mind, not particularly limited philosophical conceptual questions. So I think there's a lot of acceptance of that idea that we should know about the brain. It's a fascinating subject, and great strides are made all the time in that subject. But, you know, what should we conclude from that, that other approaches to thinking about the mind are worthless? Well, that's the negative side. I'm not so happy about that. So two things struck me in the remarks I was listening to just a moment ago. Pat saying, well, conceptual analysis is pointless because you can't discover about the brain through that. Well, obviously you can't. You can't make empirical discoveries through conceptual analysis. Mm. Does that mean that it's completely pointless to think about one's concepts and try to get clear about them when thinking about certain questions about the mind? No, I don't think so. I think it was quite important to think about our concept of consciousness and figure out whether we've got different notions of consciousness which were confusing with each other, in trying to give some kind of account of how the brain generates consciousness or deals with it. So I think conceptual inquiry can have a role. It's just that the mistake of some old-style philosophical approaches was to think it was the only thing which was of interest. So I'm opposed to the idea that neuroscience is the only thing of interest if we're interested in the mind. I think there are many approaches we can take.
Well, let me ask you, you're a big-time philosopher. Then when the notion is put out there, and I don't know if I'll articulate this exactly correctly, but that there's no other thing that is consciousness, that consciousness is just is simply the brain doing what the brain does. That is consciousness. As a Bigfoot philosopher, do you accept that, Colin McGinn?
No, I don't. I mean, that's as you've just explained it, that would be just classic materialistic reduction, which is the idea that you can reduce consciousness to a brain process like neurons firing. That's something which I wouldn't think was plausible anymore. I mean, it's a very dogmatic view in a way, because why should we assume that what's described, how the brain is described in current neuroscience, explains what consciousness is? Maybe the sciences of the brain and of the mind will change in all sorts of ways, and it'll turn out that consciousness is dependent upon some other aspects of the brain which we don't even talk about.
So what might it be beyond neurons firing? As a philosopher, how do you look at that?
We have no idea what it might be beyond that. People have tried to come up with ideas of the correlates of consciousness with, you know, not make great success. But no doubt there's something in the brain which is a correlate of consciousness. No doubt something about the brain explains it. But to think that, you know, what we now know about the brain is an adequate explanatory basis, I think would be something. I don't think Pat and Paul would accept that. But there have been philosophers who've thought that. They've thought that it's just straightforwardly true that pain is C-fiber firing. We know that there are C-fibers. We know that they fire. We know what neural firing is. Pain is that. Well, that seems to me a dogmatic position, because why should we assume that that is what pain is? Maybe it's not. Maybe we've We need to have a much more theoretical revolution to understand things like pain.
Let me put it to the church ones. Pat, Paul, neurons firing, not necessarily enough, not necessarily nearly enough to understand consciousness. What do you say?
Well, it's very important to realize, of course, that neuroscience is in its infancy. I don't think anybody thinks within neuroscience, and certainly I don't and Paul doesn't think, that we have an adequate explanation of consciousness or an adequate explanation of pain. But in the case of pain, I mean, it's very clear that C fibers play an extremely important role in pain.
What are C fibers?
Let me just say a little bit about that. There are nerves in the periphery of the body. So let's suppose that you put your hand on a very hot stove. Then there are going to be signals that go from your hand up through your arm into the spinal cord and up into the brain. And some of those fibers are called A fibers, and their signals travel very fast because those fibers are what we call myelinated. They kind of have insulation on them. And there's other fibers that are evolutionarily very old, and they're called C fibers. And both of those fibers are important for feeling pain, and both of them carry signals, but the C signals are a little bit slower.
So there's the technical, but Colin McKim
says... And they are nasty.
Right, but even if you understand that, he's saying, is that really enough to build a theory, a philosophical theory of consciousness on? There may be so much that we don't know.
Well, of course, that's my point, is that neuroscience is in its infancy, and nobody thinks that signals in C fibers are the be-all and the end-all. But, you know, it's also very important to understand that in the domain of consciousness, we've actually made quite a lot of interesting progress. We're beginning to understand what happens under anesthesia when you lose consciousness. We're beginning to understand the difference between being in deep sleep and being awake and in a dreaming state. Between being in vegetative state and not. We are beginning to understand at the level of the neuron the difference between paying attention and not. Now, this is all a beginning, and none of us has ever claimed, and of course, McGinn is setting up a straw man here, but none of us has ever claimed that we have a complete explanation for these things, but we do have a very large tiger, and we've really got this guy by the tail.
Colin McGinn, do you think science will ever explain it all, or will there always be a role for the philosopher beyond the latest scientific frontier?
Well, in the case of, there will always be a role for philosophers if we're not considering questions about the mind. There are many other parts of philosophy, of course, which philosophers are interested in. But if we're considering the mind, there will always be a role for certain questions about the mind, because there are always going to be some conceptual issues. It's very unlikely. Suppose neuroscience develops in some very radical way, and it becomes as sophisticated as physics is now. There are still many philosophical questions about physics that the philosophers think about. So it seems to me not really on the cards that we get to a point where philosophers had nothing to say about the sciences. There'll always be concepts that are used in the sciences which are, you know, general concepts that need to be analyzed and understood and be clear about.
Colin McGinn, I know we just have you for another minute, but I wish you'd leave us with what big question we should be asking as we listen to the church lens here about the intersection of neuroscience and philosophy, a sort of laymen and women looking on and listening on to you pros duking it out here. What question would you leave us with, Colin McGinn?
Well, the point you were just raising that Paul raised earlier about whether extensions of our knowledge of the brain might make us stop using our normal mental concepts like emotion and thought and so on. Again, I find that to be overreaching. I don't think that's very likely. I think that there are different levels of description of reality, and we find a more basic level. We found the physics underlying chemistry. We don't stop talking about chemistry. In the same way, I will find out the mechanics in the brain of the mechanisms which subserve our mental lives. I don't think that would lead, and that would be very interesting and worthwhile. I don't think that will lead us to abandon all talk of ordinary talk of the emotions, and so I will keep that talk, and I think it'll be useful. So I'm just skeptical about the idea that that neuroscience is the complete account of everything and will eventually subsume everything about the way we talk. I mean, the novels will be written in the language of neuroscience, for example, seems to me rather doubtful.
Colin McGinn at the University of Miami, thanks very much for joining us for a few minutes today.
My pleasure.
Paul Churchland, he's not just grabbing that out of thin air. The words we use to describe brain, mind, emotion, passion, you've paid a lot of attention to, as has Pat. What about you're hoping for a change in vocabulary? I almost think you do anticipate novels where brain chemistry moves in instead of passion, emotion, love, etc.
Well, Colin, skepticism is certainly salutary, and he may well be right. But if there are changes in the way that we all come to speak about one another and think about one another, if those changes do come, they will come because they earned their way into our common vocabulary, because they gave us a better grip on what's going on inside us. I don't have an enthusiasm here for replacing ordinary mental vocabulary with a scientific vocabulary just because one's scientific. I suspect that our ordinary vocabulary perhaps hides as much as it reveals.
Words like what? I threw some out, but I don't know if I've got the right ones. What are some potentially...
Well, a big worry here concerns something we can all agree on, and Colin will agree on this too. Perhaps the most important way in which we represent one another's mental lives is in terms of the beliefs we have and the desires we have and the hopes and the fears that we have. And to identify the hopes and fears, we specify them with a sentence. You hope that your children will grow up healthy. You fear that there'll be another storm this winter. And here you specify something with a sentence. Now, human talk in the marketplace and over the dinner table assumes that these sentential states are extraordinarily important. Indeed, most people think of one's mental life as an internal dance of sentences of one kind or another.
Well, more than that, if you talk about taking away belief, hope, fear, desire, that sounds like the very stuff of life. You'll have dukes up.
Indeed so. But, of course, the worry is not that we don't have an inner life. We certainly do. The worry is, are we conceiving of it in the right way? And the worries start to accrue when you realize that a mental life is something that's shared with many other creatures on the planet, golden retrievers and kitty cats and horses and whales and so forth. They all have a rich mental life, but none of them uses language. Indeed, humans don't use language until they're almost 2 years old. And even if you have a form of brain damage called global aphasia on the left side, which completely knocks out your capacity for processing sentences of any kind, you're still a conscious creature. You're still wise. You're still loving, you're still insightful.
Okay. But I have to ask then, if you say this language, it may be primitive, it may obscure as much as it reveals. If you take it away, doesn't it? It seems as though we're like animals. Are we not making robots more human, but humans more robot?
We're not going to take it away. The guess is that a new vocabulary will emerge from the growing sciences, which will prove to be more useful even over the dinner table and in the marketplace. And we won't stop talking about our mental lives. We'll just be talking about it in a language that's much more penetrating than the one we currently use.
Let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. I think that we used to think of memory as being one sort of major single kind of thing. And neuroscience has now shown us that there are a number of very different memory systems. And what has become part of the normal vocabulary of ordinary people is the distinction between their episodic memory on the one hand, where they remember such things as what they had for breakfast, and skill learning or procedural memory on the other hand. This is just part of how people think now. People didn't used to realize that there was a big difference between deep sleep and what we call REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, or dreaming sleep. That's just part of the normal vocabulary of the way people talk now. They talk about their REM periods versus their deep sleep periods.
So we'll begin to subset belief, desire, hope, fear, I have this or that kind of...
Predicting exactly how we're going to come to think about those sorts of representations, including the representations or the motives that come from the emotions, how that's going to change remains to be seen. The change may be little, it may be very substantial. But the idea of change in and of itself, I think, is often, when the change is explanatorily useful, it gets right into the vocabulary.
But if we take away the poetry, even if it's crude poetry.
Nobody wants to take away anything. I mean, novelists should keep writing the way. But, you know, there are novelists who are picking up on these sorts of things and are now writing stories based on what the novelist has learned.
Tom, let me give you an example of something that happened to Pat and me to illustrate that such language may end up displaying a poetry of its own. This happened a couple of years ago, actually. I was at home at the end of the day making dinner because Pat was at a meeting of the chairs and the chancellors, and they were confronting some long problem, and the meeting ran late. She came home, and I said, "Hello, dear," as she came through the door. And she said, "Oh, Paul, don't talk to me. My brain is awash in glucocorticoids. My dopamine levels are at rock bottom. My serotonin system isn't working at all. My amygdala is afire. If it wasn't for my endogenous opiates, I'd have driven the car into a tree on the way home."
And you're posing this as poetry for us. This is what will be poetry. You're 2020.
She then said, "My dopamine levels need raising. Pour me a Chardonnay. I'll be down in a minute."
I don't know. Okay, I get it. And you know, maybe we're cavemen and women compared to what will come later. Maybe glucocorticoids or whatever it was you said, Paul, turns into poetry. But I don't know. Listeners, what do you think? Art is calling from East Lansing, Michigan. Art, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello. Boy, I love this conversation you have. I think we really need to explore and learn to extend our reach and our amazing potential and overcome a lot of our limitations and better human life. And that's what you all are doing. My concern is attacked by the religious community. I see that their huge franchise, they may feel threatened. And as we saw the history with Galileo, their huge, very powerful propaganda reach can be brought to bear on this research.
But are you so sure? What if it turns out that somehow belief, even in mechanical terms, has a real salutary effect on, I don't know, the human biology, mind, and our spirits?
That'd be amazing. I'm just concerned because you see what's happening with Darwin and evolution and their attack for there. And it's possible that something good can come out of it in that area, but I'm concerned that they like to say no, and they like to stop.
Well, I'll ask you about that, but I read you're in bioscience. Do you agree with the direction the Churchlands are pointing for our understanding of consciousness? Art?
Oh, do I? I'm sorry. I thought you were asking your guests there. I think that they're very conservative. They want us to regress back to the past. I don't see that they welcome any science. They see it as a threat.
Who's the they you're talking about? You're back to
I know it's very vague, but this is just a concept, okay?
Yeah.
Is that they have seen the expansion of science in recent decades, and a lot of the media portrays science as scary science fiction and how it's harming man, look at nuclear energy.
Right, hey, so you're talking about the religious community as well. Of course, there are many faces to that, but Pat and Paul, how about it? Are you going to be the new Galileos, you and your ilk?
Oh, dear me, I hope not. Galileo did suffer a bit towards the end, thanks to the intransigence of the church. But my first impulse is to make common cause with the religions of the world. If we can figure out how to make an infant's childhood better and more effective, if we can learn how to expand the role of a healthy conscience in people's lives, if we can expand the degree to which humans embrace one another and are patient and trusting and so forth, then I don't think we'll be at odds with the church. Quite the reverse. We'll be helping them to do at least part of their traditional job. On the other hand,
if you start deconstructing the very notion of belief, That's a jackhammer at the foundation, isn't it?
It may be reconstructed in some other terms, just as you began to suggest. Even if the brain is not an internal dance of sentences, as tradition assumes, it's still true that a large portion of the human race embraces religions, and that's something that we want to understand. It is bound to bring some uncertainty and some negative reactions. I think your caller is quite correct. But we've been here before with regard to the biological sciences and the many techniques for health, things like vaccines and surgery and anesthetics were strongly resisted by the church in the early years of the medical sciences because they perhaps understandably thought they were against certain aspects of doctrine. But even church doctrine grows up over time. They learn too, along with the rest of us. So I don't see an apocalyptic fight here, though there's bound to be some scuffles. I'm sure your caller is right.
You know, I think one thing too is that we are learning that techniques of meditation are bring about changes in the brain, that they're probably very good for the brain, and that feelings of spirituality, which one has in meditation, although they're really effects of the brain, are very important to people, and they play a role in the quality of life. And there's no reason to sort of downgrade those things. On the contrary,
though
posing I'm a meditator, them as feel- and I think it's great.
Right, but posing it as feeling rather than, you know, something transcendent. Well, those are fighting words right there. Though as we learn more and more, we are all in the boat together here.
It depends. I mean, there's many religions that I think are very open to this. I think Buddhism, for example, is one. But I think there are many Christians who take a very sort of broad-minded view of these things and are really interested in issues about quality of life and doing good here on earth, as opposed to faith for its own sake and hoping for the hereafter.
Let me take a call from Brookline, Massachusetts. Andy, you're on the air with Patricia and Paul Churchland.
Hey, I think that it's a very progressive way of thinking about it. I think that, the ideals of many religions, such as Buddhism, which is an actual religion, Hinduism, and the different aspects of Christianity sort of are moving towards this. And we, instead of sort of fighting this, I think that the poetry will be greater in explaining how our minds work and how our experiences play out.
So you're ready to let go of the notions like desire, hope, fear, and what? Subset them, dissect them, take them down to the details, Andy?
Well, I don't really think that they're going to go away. I mean, I think that's a very simplistic way of thinking about it, to be honest. I mean, just because you can explain it in another way doesn't mean that it's any less valid.
Let's turn to it, Paul. Hope, fear, desire, those are words that you put out there. Do they go away? Do they become historic notions, antique notions, supplanted by more?
It's a scientific question, Tom, and no philosophical argument is going to answer it. We have to wait and see how the unfolding science displays itself. I was trying to build a case, try to establish a worry a few minutes ago, and I'll go back to it again.
Yeah.
The point is that we see on this planet, in humans and in almost all the other creatures, enormous amounts of intelligence where there's no capacity for manipulating the structures of language. Language at all. And it suggests that our conception of ourselves as having our heads filled with a dance of sentential states may be a reflection of the fact that we're language users. Now, language is extremely important, but to use it as a model, and use the structures of language as a model for the structure of all cognition, I suspect may be a monumental mistake.
It's lost in the mumbo-jumbo, a world of mumbo-jumbo.
No, I think it's not mumbo-jumbo at all. I think that the conceptual framework we use to understand persons is probably the most complex theoretical framework any human ever learns. Mm. The worry is that it may be misleading in the same way that the notion of a flat, immobile Earth was misleading. It was a great shock to people 300-400 years ago to consider the possibility that they were all moving at 1,000 miles an hour towards the east because the Earth is spinning. It's a shock apt to consider the idea that our brains may not be primarily the seat of a dance of sentential states. But this isn't the enthusiasm of a prophet. This is simply the worried guess of someone who's looking how the neurosciences are playing out. There are alternative theories of how brains represent. They're hard to get across on a talk show, but they are already in place, and they're serving as an inspiration for artificial neural networks, which turn out to do very interesting things, like recognize faces and recognize voices and have sensory motor coordination, the same sorts of things that animals can have. So if I'm looking at the horizon says that the idea that these sentential states are important is a dubious idea, even though it's deeply entrenched in everyone's consciousness, including my own, I freely confess.
We hear it in every sentence, but right there we lift the curtain on something really fascinating. What's on the other side? We'll all wait and see, but we're grateful for your work over all these years. Patricia and Paul Churchland in San Diego, thanks so much for your time and insights today. Really great speaking
with
you.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom. It was a great pleasure.
Thanks for joining us. Listeners, thank you for being here as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.